Support for WVIK comes from Kathleen Collins at the Dragonfly in Bettendorf. Using both conventional and alternative counseling methods for empowerment to help create change for individuals and couples. More information is at KathleenCollinsCounseling.com.
You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and an important report was released recently that has some significant ramifications for the American economy, and especially for those of us here in the Heartland. It addresses industrial policy in China and compares how much other countries, including the U.S., stack up. It's important because a recurring theme from this show is the impact of globalization in our region, and that's why I'm happy to have one of the co-authors of the report with me today on Heartland Politics. He's Scott Kennedy. He's a senior advisor and trustee chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Got a very interesting background, which I'll have him share with you here in just a minute. The report is titled Red Ink, Estimating Chinese Industrial Policy Spending in Comparative Perspective. And you can read it on the CSIS website at csis.org. Scott, welcome and thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Robin, for having me. It's great to be with you and the audience today.
It's an important report, and I want you to share the major findings. But before you do, maybe talk a little bit about your background. As I described, is unique. I think your perspective on this is probably more relevant than a lot of others, just because of your background.
Well, thanks so much. Well, I'm talking to you today from Washington, D.C., which is where I was born and grew up. But I spent 15 years as professor at Indiana University in Bloomington, and that was an amazing experience for myself, for my family. It let me make sure that I understood that America is a very interesting, complex, diverse, wonderful place that also has a variety of different experiences and engagements with China, with Asia, with globalization. And when I came back to Washington, D.C., to my hometown to work in think tank land, that 15 years served me really well. And I think, on all of the work that I do now on policy issues, on looking at how China's economy affects us and the rest of the world and what we ought to do about it, my time in Bloomington and the Midwest was so helpful. We try to go back as often as we can to see friends. It's why I'm really excited to be talking to you today.
Great. You're a native Midwesterner. You've also had the opportunity to live in China for a significant part of your life.
Indeed. Starting in college, I started traveling to China in the late 80s. And aside from the 2.5 years of the pandemic, regularly traveled to China, lived there 4 times over that process. But I spent about 60% of my time in the U.S., about 35% of my time in China, and about 5% on United Airlines. And as a result of that, I've gotten to see a lot of the country. I just came back, actually, from 5 weeks in Asia, visiting Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan. I was actually trying to get to China, and I think everybody knows what the heck's going on in Shanghai, Beijing, elsewhere with COVID and the lockdowns and everything, making it very difficult, unpredictable. So I still want to get there. I still think it's really important for us to be able to try and understand China and figure out how to manage and compete with it, that we travel and interact with people as much as we can. And the lack of being able to do so has been particularly frustrating. What I really like to do is actually what you're doing today, which is interviewing me. I really like interviewing and talking to people, and Zoom is not my favorite medium. It's person to person, so that's been a rich experience, which I hope to resume soon.
So give us kind of an overview of this report, I guess the major findings, Scott, and why it's important for us Americans, and especially our listeners out here, why this is important to all of us, the major findings.
Sure. So everybody knows that China has a state capitalist system, that it plays by different rules, that it's at the very micro level involved in supporting state-owned enterprises and discriminating against foreign companies in China, and making it more difficult for the U.S. to compete in third markets around the world. But we've always had a very difficult time, you know, summarizing exactly how big China's state capitalist system is and what we should do about it, partly because it's very untransparent, very opaque. And so we would point to this sector or that sector, steel or aluminum or semiconductors or something, and say there's an unfair practice. But we've never been able to put a number on it. And our report is the first effort to quantify in a very systematic way and say, altogether, here's how much China spends on industrial policy, and not only what it is in absolute terms, but as a percent of its economy, and then compare China to seven other economies. So we could say that China is more equal or less than others. And what 8 months of hard work by our team here at CSIS has found, including my co-authors who deserve kudos for their work, Gerard DePippo from the economics program and Ilaria Mazzocco from my program, the trustee chair at CSIS here, we come up with two big empirical findings. The first is China spends a lot on industrial policy. The way we do the math, which is as conservative as possible, we wanted to make this bulletproof, not open to criticism by the Chinese or anyone else, is about in 2019 about 1.73% of Chinese GDP equivalent is what they spent on industrial policy. It's about $250 billion in U.S. dollars, or in nominal terms, or about $400 billion plus in purchasing power parity terms. That is larger than China's defense budget. So how do they spend this money? Well, partly it's those subsidies that come out of their government budget, but it's also R&D tax incentives, also below market credit, where China uses its state banking system to shovel money to privileged companies, mostly state-owned enterprises. It's also not requiring state-owned enterprises to pay back their bills. So basically writing off, you know, if they get payments receivable, not having to pay the bill. That's a subsidy in our book. It's free land, massive amounts of free, cheap, inexpensive land also supports Chinese companies. The second conclusion is that China spends far more on industrial policy than anybody else. We looked at seven other economies, including the United States, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Germany, France, Brazil, and we found that China spends way more than all of them in absolute dollar amounts and as a percentage of their economy. Second place with South Korea at 0.7% of GDP compared to China at 1.73%. So less than half, and in dollar amounts, they're just way, way ahead of everybody. So China is really juicing their competitiveness through industrial policy spending, and I really want to emphasize how conservative and careful we were in the measurements. We could modify our assumptions just a little bit and easily double or triple what the Chinese estimate is. So those are the big conclusions. This is really a math-heavy report, and sorry for folks that have to wade through it, but that's the basis of then now being able to have a conversation. Well, heck, what do we do about it?
Yeah, it's. I thought it was interesting that how you defined industrial policy as well. And the United States is regarded as a free market capitalist economy, but we engage in this as well, just not to that extent. And I think there's a coming debate over the extent of that, but. What are some examples where we are similar to China, where we're involved in the economy, but other areas where they're just far outpacing us?
Sure. Yeah. Well, certainly the U.S. federal government and some state and local governments provide some kinds of incentives for research and development. And I'd consider that kind of the good kind of industrial policy. You give money to universities, certain types of organizations, companies to delve into basic sciences as well as applications to continue to help our economy move forward. And the United States does that with a lot of different industries, particularly the Department of Defense at the federal level, which is, you know, seeded money for research on semiconductors, originally for the internet, certain battery technology. And so certainly we do that, not nearly to the amount that the Chinese do. We provide tax breaks for a variety of different things. You know, if you open up a company in a science and technology park, the federal government or certain state and local governments will provide you support. You know, as we now are trying to provide more support for the semiconductor industry, Congress has now been considering legislation for some time that might put about $52 billion into the semiconductor industry, which is a pretty large dollar amount compared to what we usually do, because, as you said, we're a free market capitalist economy. Things that China does that's particularly different is their financial system is really structured to follow the direction of their state planners and direct money and credit to companies that are doing what the state wants in terms of which industries they're involved in. And this is mostly private companies, but I mean, mostly state-owned companies, but it also includes private Chinese companies as well. They also have state investment funds, large buckets of billions of dollars, which they invest as equity in companies to produce in certain industries, which we do not have. So there's a lot of things, there are a few things that we do at a relatively modest scale. I think because our worry is that the government doesn't know better than industry, which I think is correct. And the Chinese are the other end of the spectrum, which I think is just one point of this last make in this segment is that, you know, just because the Chinese are spending a lot more doesn't necessarily mean that it's smart spending or that we ought to copy them. In fact, I think we ought to be very, very hesitant to go down that road and be much more humble in the role that government plays in our economy. But nevertheless, the difference is really what stands out here.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Scott Kennedy, who's the co-author of a very important study. I think it's vital to our country, but also our region. It's about China and industrial policy. We get a little academic here, but I think Scott, my guest, is doing a good job with kind of breaking this down and why this is important. The report is called Red Ink, Estimating Chinese Industrial Policy Spending in Comparative Perspective. Scott's a senior advisor and trustee chair in Chinese Business and Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. I keep wanting to say NCIS, but...
no worries.
Scott's talked a little bit about the research, the big picture view. I'm curious, I guess, in talking about this, okay, you found this out, and we have the World Trade Organization that's kind of the judge, the judicial branch of kind of mediating complaints on countries taking unfair advantage of trade. And we've heard about this. We've seen it in the Midwest. I mean, we lost 5 million manufacturing jobs in the first decade of this century. And a lot of times steel makers and aluminum makers, and we heard President Trump accuse other countries of unfair practices, including China. How does the WTO police this? And with what you have here, it seems pretty clear. They're engaged, China's engaged very heavily. And how does the WTO try to adjudicate this to create a fair trading system?
Well, I'm in general a fan of the WTO. I think its mission when it was created in 1995 as the successor to the General Agreement on Trades and Tariffs was a positive step forward. It set basic rules for tariffs, for non-tariff barriers, for fair trade, how to deal with issues like subsidies, intellectual property, and both create general rules as well as try to enforce them. And it's done a reasonably good job for about 10 to 15 years until about 2010 or so. The WTO was relatively effective in acting at least as a speed bump to slow countries down in their use of protectionist policies and industrial policy. They've not done as good a job since, and certainly the last 7 to 8 years, the WTO has basically ceased to be relevant, in part because countries that are members of the WTO don't all report their subsidies and what they do, which is required. And the WTO rules basically say you must prove injury before you can get relief. And by the time you get to the WTO and prove that you've been injured and can then seek relief, it's already too late. And hence, post facto trying to bring jobs back, that's really not an effective measure. So what we really need to see is actually, another important part of this is that what the WTO asks countries to report on with regard to subsidies is a very teeny sliver of actual state support. In our report, in what we've just published, only about 10% of China's subsidies would have been reported. It's sort of what comes out of their government budget. But 90% of how the Chinese juice their system is through the credit financial system, through land, inexpensive land, and other tactics. And so really what we need to do is step up the reporting requirements to cover not just fiscal government expenditures, but many other kinds. I don't know if the WTO itself is prepared to do that. China and other countries that intervene heavily in their economy would oppose these measures. And in the WTO, it's a consensus-based organization. So it just takes one of 165 members to say no, to not get something done. So the U.S. is going to have to find a way to work with allies and other like-minded countries to set new standards on what needs to be reported, and then come up with different ways to respond. Now, one of the things I think it is important to notice is that as a product of China's entry into the global economy over the last three decades, that you just reminded listeners, that it certainly had a huge effect on manufacturing in the United States in terms of job losses. It's been mixed. There's been some parts of the economy where we've had job gains, some significant where there've been losses, and those have been regionally distributed, with the Midwest taking the brunt of the pain there. We should point out that one of the things that we find in our study is that a variety of countries who've also increased trade dramatically with China have not had as big a hit on their manufacturing sectors the way we have. And so if you look at Japan, Germany, Taiwan, their manufacturing sectors have gone down some, but not to the extent to ours has. So part of the solution is finding ways to push back really hard on China, and maybe the WTO is not going to be that mechanism anymore. But also it's about taking care of ourselves, investing in manufacturing, and supporting infrastructure, making the rest of the world want to invest in manufacturing in the United States as well, making sure we have enough high-quality engineers who want to work in manufacturing. I think those are all part of the solution, not just the fact that we've got to figure out how to deal with the China challenge head-on.
I was going to ask about two key industries in our region in the Midwest. One was manufacturing. You just answered that. What about agriculture? Is there anything in your study that shows disproportionate investment in China with agriculture that would impact our farmers here in the region?
Yeah. I think agriculture is a little bit more complex. We don't do the math on agriculture subsidies. We focus entirely on industry for this report. And so that is a gap that needs to be filled. My general view is that, broadly speaking, countries around the world, including the United States, have provided agricultural subsidies in a variety of segments and product areas, from cotton to elsewhere. And what we try to do is have rules that provide some kind of constraints about how far economies go. What I would say is with regard to China, we were probably in the noughts from 2000 to 2010 going in the right direction, where the Chinese had decided they were going to reduce their tariff and non-tariff barriers to imported agricultural products and diversify their production to higher and not depend just totally on domestic sources of wheat and other grains. And as a result of that, you saw significant increases in American exports of wheat, soybeans, and other products. But following the launch of the trade war in 2017, U.S. agricultural exports really began to suffer. And only following the phase one deal in January of 2020 did we kind of begin to resume the success that we had. On top of that, the Chinese, I think, partly as a result of COVID, have changed policy tracks and are now looking to be more self-sufficient in agriculture and going to make it more difficult. So American farmers have been hit by the double whammy of the trade war and China's own sort of growing protectionism. So that my guess is that if someone does that research, they'll come up with pretty big numbers, but a lot of things that you can't quantify that are going to make it hard for American agricultural exporters to do business with China.
One of the things I like best about your report, and again, I encourage our listeners to take a look online at the center's website, but you looked at three different areas: aluminum, semiconductors, and electric vehicles. And I, for time considerations, because I have another question or two, but electric vehicles are interesting because I think our region's really trying to make a pitch, especially in Illinois. We've got a Rivian facility in central Illinois. State government is really looks interested in trying to make Illinois more of a hub for electric vehicles. What did you find in that case study?
In the case of electric vehicles, which I've looked at for a long time, is that China has spent about $1 trillion Chinese dollars from 2009 to last year in subsidies to support that industry in one way or the other. That's about $150 billion U.S. dollars equivalent. And that's for rebates for consumers who buy electric vehicles to make them more affordable, for the battery makers, for R&D, for the infrastructure, for charging stations that are along highways or in cities or in apartment complexes, for government procurement, another big part of the support. So to give government agencies in China the wherewithal to buy electric vehicles. Those are mostly, of course, they're encouraging to buy local Chinese-made electric vehicles, not foreign exports to China. That's a lot. And as a result, China's production and consumption of electric vehicles and their role in the electric vehicle battery sector has jumped dramatically. Now, there's a lot that the U.S. could do to support the electrical vehicle industry. I don't encourage us to directly follow the Chinese model. Again, I don't think the U.S. government ought to spend $150 billion on this industry, which in China, that accounted for 30% of all sales, not just 30% of profits. We don't have that kind of money. And I think what we've seen in China is overproduction and hundreds of electric vehicle companies, and so a lot of wasted money as well. We shouldn't have that. We should have a much more efficient economy than the Chinese do. But we can be much more targeted and smart in our investments, and the whole elements of the supply chain, from the ingredients that go into batteries to the production of the battery themselves, to the manufacturing of the vehicles, to the servicing, to the parts and components. The U.S. can help build a pretty comprehensive supply chain domestically and with like-minded countries around the world, so we don't have to depend heavily on China for this sector at all. We can be very competitive. The U.S. has one of the world's largest auto markets, and going green is important for our economy in many different ways. And so even though we might be adjusting the way the engine is collects and burns fuels instead of fossil fuels using electricity from other sources, the auto and transportation sector still can drive economic growth in the U.S. if we manage the sector in the right way.
We only have time for one more question. We've just kind of really taken a summary look at the report. Again, I urge our listeners to take a look at it online. My question is, we've got a piece of legislation before Congress, the Competes Act, and I'm surprised it hasn't gone through. It's a rare area of bipartisanship. If you could take just a couple minutes, that's about all we have left here. Give a brief overview of what the bill does to share with our listeners. And if you think that's the right approach that the country should be taking to meet this challenge.
Sure. The COMPETES legislation that Congress is currently considering is a combination of a lot of different pieces of legislation brought together under one roof that the House and the Senate both had passed versions of over the last several months and year. And those versions are slightly different, and they have formed a conference committee to try and negotiate the various differences to get a single bill and pass it and get it to the president's desk. I think the reason that it's taken so long to get there is that, one, it's very complex and covers many different issues for three kinds of buckets of issues. One is promotion, investment in American industries, in R&D, in universities, particularly in semiconductors, but in other sectors as well. There's also a variety of defensive measures to protect the U.S. economy from unfair practices and to deal with national security-related issues that intersect with high tech. And there's some trade-related issues, policies as well, about how we ought to govern trade and investment. It's a very large piece, and I think that complexity has slowed things down as well. The other thing is the fact that on every other issue, the Republicans and Democrats seem to not be able to find much common ground. And so that, to some extent, affects their ability in this space. That said, my guess is that by midsummer, by the July recess, or by the end of July, before the August recess, and when everyone launches into their midterm election campaign, we'll most likely have a bill that reaches the president's desk. If we don't get the full bill, I think we will get a partial bill that centers on the semiconductor industry, the CHIPS Act, at $52 billion in funding. That's not enough. I think if you want to compete globally, not just with the Chinese, but everyone else, the U.S. government needs to provide smart investments and support. This bill largely does that. There are a couple places that you would can have an argument about. Some of the parts of the House bill, to me, look a little bit more protectionist than I think would be appropriate for what we're trying to achieve. But at the end of the day, this bill is like a dissertation. A done dissertation is the right kind of dissertation. And the same for this. A bill that passes is the most important kind of bill, even if it's not perfect. So we don't want to let perfect be the enemy of the good here. And hopefully both houses of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, will see that, and we will get a good constructive piece of legislation out of and show that Washington is part of the solution, not just a problem that we all have to worry about.
If you're interested in learning more, go to CSIS.org. It's for the Center for Strategic International Studies in Washington, D.C. That's where Scott Kennedy works. He's been our guest today. He's a senior advisor and trustee chair in Chinese business and economics, and co-author of a report that's been our major topic today, titled Red Ink, Estimating Chinese Industrial Policy Spending and Comparative Perspective. They did a great job of making that clear for the average reader, and I highly recommend folks take a look. Scott, thank you so much for taking the time today, and I'll continue to keep an eye on your work on this important topic.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's been good talking with you today.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.